Governor Janet Mills on pandemic response, the state budget, and the siege at the U.S. Capitol. Governor Mills joined the many government leaders yesterday denouncing the violence and destruction yesterday at the U.S. Capitol. It unfolded as she was dealing with other big issues, including the state's COVID vaccination rollout and a proposed state budget. Governor Mills is scheduled to present her budget to the legislature tomorrow. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Governor Mills is our guest. We will discuss the impact of the pandemic on tax revenues and the state coffers, what her legislative priorities are in this new year, and what it will take to lift the early closure mandate. What are your questions for the governor? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, Governor Janet Mills joins me to discuss her upcoming biennial budget proposal, the state's COVID response and vaccine rollout, and other pressing issues affecting Mainers. As always, we invite your questions and comments. You can call 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call. Again, the number 1-800-399-3566. Governor Mills, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thank you, Jen. Good to be here.
Let's begin with the shocking scene out of Washington yesterday with the Trump supporters storming the nation's capital. What was going through your mind as you watched events unfold?
I think the same thing that was going through everybody else's mind, that is, how has it come to this? How has it come to this? There was an election 2 months ago, an election that was validated state after state, time after time, place after place. No evidence of any widespread fraud or anything that would disturb the count that was so carefully made by each state. No evidence of fraud or abuse of the process. So the election stands. And all they were doing yesterday in Congress was basically certifying, accepting, and receiving the results of the Electoral College votes. For that fairly simple and routine and constitutional exercise to result in mob violence is unheard of. It was disgraceful. It was one of the saddest days in American history, in my book. We expect the peaceful transfer of power. That's a hallmark of our democracy. That has to proceed as it has proceeded in the past. I remember being at several inaugurations. I remember being at Bill Clinton's inauguration in 1993 and in Obama's inaugurations, and when the previous president, when they had a pleasant lunch and conferences and exchanged information and data and policy information. And then the outgoing president and his family walked to the helicopter and took off from the grounds of the U.S. Capitol, and the new president stepped forward and took the oath. I don't care which party it is. I don't care which person it is. But for that to occur in peaceful, dignified fashion is so important to the underpinnings of our democracy. To see that whole process disrupted in such a hateful manner was disturbing to the nth degree.
So many of us have so many questions, including about how this could happen, how the protesters could get past the Capitol Police. As a former prosecutor, as a former attorney general, you have a specific lens as you watch this. What are your questions?
Well, the questions are the same ones posed by the press, everyone from Fox to CNN to CBS, ABC, and NBC. And that is, how was the Capitol not prepared for this? I think there were signs that it was coming down the pike. I think what they expect are peaceful, although very vocal, demonstrations on the Mall, the Capitol Mall, which is where things usually occur, and everything from the base of the Lincoln Memorial past the reflecting pool, onto the Washington Monument and down to the Capitol grounds. But No one expects a breach of the physical security of the U.S. Capitol or a breach into the House chamber and Senate chambers, especially during sessions in particular. No one expects that. So my concern is what happens from here forward. We know what the response was to 9/11 and the security measures that took place and have become embedded in our culture now. I hate to see us living in lockdown or living in quasi-martial law systems. I don't want to see that happen. But we have to do everything we can to protect the sanctity of our democracy. And the U.S. Capitol is not just a symbol of that democracy, but the embodiment of full and fair deliberation and discourse that must be protected at the highest levels and at every level.
And it wasn't only at the U.S. Capitol. As you well know, many state capitals around the nation saw protests. I'm wondering, was there any activity at the main state capitol yesterday, at the main state house?
I understand there were before the Congress went into session, there was a line of people on the sidewalk peacefully protesting the results of the election. I'm not aware of any violence, and I trust that kind of peaceful protest may continue without violent outbursts.
And some other state capitals were evacuated as a matter of caution. Was the state house in Maine evacuated, and was there any other activity that, on the part of law enforcement to protect you and any others in the building?
Well, first, there wasn't much going on in the state house. There isn't much going on in terms of personal contact. In fact, our staff are basically skeletal crew. Many people are working from home. In terms of any security, I can't comment on that. I haven't asked about any additional security. I haven't asked for any additional security, but to the extent they're doing any, I'm not informed and I'm not going to comment on it.
Okay. Well, let's move on to why we had originally invited you onto the program, yeah. Governor Mills, when we talked to your office a couple weeks ago. Tomorrow, you are scheduled to present your biennial budget to the state legislature. Will that happen tomorrow?
It certainly will, on time. Okay. Both the supplemental budget and the proposed biennial budget, both of which will be taken up by the Appropriations Committee in the coming weeks and months, and I'm sure it'll be digested fully and aired in public hearings and work sessions, and I expect a full debate over every provision in the budget, both the supplemental budget and the biennial budget. I look forward to that.
I can only imagine it's a very tough budget and that the pandemic has affected tax revenues. What is the very latest? What do we know about the impact of the pandemic on state coffers?
Well, there's no easy answer to that. The impact has been serious, obviously significant, and we defer to the Revenue Forecasting Committee to give us accurate, professional estimates of revenues into state government coffers. They did that back in July, and there were rather significant reductions in anticipated revenues then, significant reductions. They met again in the fall. Those projections came up quite a bit since the summer, and so we're basing what we do in the budget on the most recent accurate forecast from the Revenue Forecasting Commission and based on the Consensus Economic Forecasting Commission. People should understand these are sort of groups of professionals who meet publicly but kind of under the radar. It's like the Congressional Budget Office or the Government Accounting Office in Washington, D.C. You have a group of professionals who do the analysis for you. I can't make up these numbers. I can't just say, I'd like to spend X amount or I'd like to have certain amount come into the budget that we can then put towards different programs. So we start right there. And the budget is looking, I think it's going to be a healthy budget. It's going to be a budget that is balanced because that's required by the state constitution, unlike the federal budget. And it's going to be a budget that will not change tax rates and the like or create significant new programs. And we hope that it will also add to the Budget Stabilization Fund. There's been a lot of chatter about the Budget Stabilization Fund in the last couple of years. honestly, we have added more to the state budget, the state's budget stabilization fund than any administration. It's higher than it ever was before, and we expect to continue to book savings, both in the supplemental budget and the biennial budget in the stabilization fund.
And that's the fund that is often referred to as the rainy day fund, correct?
Yes, it is. That's right.
Yeah. Well, I can only imagine there were some tough decisions. Are there programs, and can you talk about places in the budget which you would have liked to be able to fund more fully and will not be able to because of the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I can get into more detail in that as we put it through the appropriations process. But what we are doing is focusing where we were focusing before, where we started focusing 2 years ago on, for instance, health care. Thanks to the Medicaid expansion that the people of Maine voted in referendum and that we implemented on day one of my administration, thanks to that, approximately 62,000 people now during this pandemic have health care that they didn't have before. So we continue that program without any significant increases, but we also continue rebuilding the public health infrastructure in Maine, which had been decimated in previous years. We started that nearly 2 years ago, and we continue to rebuild the public health infrastructure in Maine. If you remember, there were about 55 or 60 public health nurses who were laid off and whose positions were eliminated by the previous administration. We reinstated that program. The legislature reinstated that program. The legislature told us to build it back up, and we had started to do that when the pandemic hit. So that's extraordinarily important. Rebuilding the CDC. Thanks to Dr. Nirav Shah and his eagle eye, we have begun rebuilding that Department of State Government, which people know now is a life-saving enterprise. We are also trying to rebuild education, build it back up from where it was several years ago, where it had been basically decimated. And we are rebuilding reinvigorating general public purpose aid to education, continuing on the path that the legislature and the people of Maine voted for us to do. And that is, at least incrementally, more money, more state share of general purpose aid to education to help relieve the property taxpayers and to make sure that teachers continue on a path towards, for instance, $40,000 minimum teacher salary, which I think is fundamental, continuing on a path towards universal pre-K across the state, building our infrastructure to support the youngest children so that they have a healthy start in their lives.
I'm not hearing anything about the tough choices, though. Are there programs that you're not able to fund in the way that you would like to?
We are not eliminating any programs. We are not adding any programs. I would love to add a lot more to child protection services. We are adding some. We are continuing to rebuild that program. I would love to do a lot more on substance use disorder and address the very serious sort of co-occurring pandemic of opioid abuse and the serious rate of overdose deaths across the state of Maine, which has only continued to rise during this pandemic. I would love to do a lot more for that. We are doing what we can. We're doing some. We are also fundamentally trying to draw down and use as much federal funding and non-general fund sources as possible so as not to burden the taxpayers of this state, but to continue to provide the basic safety nets and public safety programs that people expect us to provide.
Let's talk about the vaccination rollout, probably the single most significant thing going on right now in Maine. Tell me about the level of federal guidance and funding the state is receiving for vaccine distribution. Has it picked up from those early days when Maine and other states were receiving only half of what was expected and very little federal guidance? Has that changed?
Not really. There is additional funding appropriated in the recent stimulus bill, but we have not received it yet. I don't believe any state has received it yet. And that will go towards training and providing space for vaccinations, providing IT support, because we're also required to report on every vaccination within 24 hours and put it into the federally required software program, things of that sort. It's a massive enterprise in every state, a massive undertaking. The federal government itself is providing the transportation. It's providing the vaccination materials themselves. We are, and healthcare facilitators, healthcare facilities across the state are standing up the ultra cold freezers. We're having gloves made. You know, can you imagine handling something that's minus 70 degrees centigrade? You can't pick it up with your hands. So gloves are not being provided by the federal government, but we're getting them made and done. We're with the help of the five major healthcare systems and providers across the state. We're developing systems for different populations to be able to access the vaccine as quickly and in as great a volume as possible. The goal is the greatest amount of good in the shortest amount of time. And the logistics involved in each different kind of vaccine makes it a very challenging exercise. The federal government, not the federal government, but the advisory committee, the ACIP, so-called, has provided some guidance that most states are following, too, in terms of who gets it when.
Sure. And to the point of logistics, on Monday, Dr. Shaw was on Maine Calling, and he talked about plans in the works for mass vaccination. I'm wondering, is there any progress on those? Anything that you can tell us about today about what it might look like in the weeks ahead as Maine prepares to vaccinate hundreds of thousands of people instead of tens of thousands of people?
Well, I'm sure he told you, I'm sorry I didn't listen to it, but I'm sure he's said many times, what we do and how we do it depends significantly on the supply. And we're not real confident in how much we're going to get, what we're going to get, and when we're going to get it. We will be told on Tuesdays what we may expect to allocate on Thursday or Friday to be received on Monday and Tuesday. It varies week to week. We expect to get some, I think, 17 or 18,000 doses of the two different kinds of vaccines on Monday. And we're continuing to make sure that healthcare workers, frontline healthcare workers in particular, are vaccinated as quickly as possible. And I think the various hospitals have done a marvelous job because they're also involved in caring for COVID patients and caring for their regular number of patients, some of them in critical care. And they've done a tremendous job setting up places and people to vaccinate and to be vaccinated every step of the way. That's going on. That's the first step. When we get that number, that's about 130,000 people in that first category that I think all states agree are the first group of people who should be vaccinated. You think about it when you get on an airplane, they say if you're traveling with a child or you're traveling with somebody else, put your mask on first. If there's trouble brewing, put your face mask on first so you can help others. These are the people, the frontline healthcare workers, who have to put their mask on first and
right.
who will be being vaccinated first.
And did I hear you correctly on Monday, 17,000 new doses?
That's what I think. We're expecting 17,000 to 18,000.
Not very many.
Yeah, 17,000. Yeah. No, I mean, look, if we were to do everybody as quickly as possible, we would want to have $90,000 to $100,000 doses every week and to be able to manage that with appropriate number of healthcare people to vaccinate and spaces available. You have to keep people under watch for 15, 20 minutes after being vaccinated just to make sure they don't have some unexpected allergic reaction or whatnot. You have to have the space to keep them six feet apart as well and to follow appropriate healthcare precautions. So a lot of logistical things that make this totally different from H1N1 or flu shot clinics, that kind of thing.
Well, we are speaking with our Governor Janet Mills. This is Maine Calling. We'll get to your comments and questions when we get back from this break.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Naturopathic Health, committed to treating the underlying causes of diseases, naturopathicme.com, and by Bull Moose, offering an option of curbside pickup on books, movies, CDs, or video games. Curbside pickup is available at checkout at bullmoose.com.
Chinese authorities control Tibet. They also try to control Tibetan Buddhism. China has even tried to select the next Buddhist leader. The U.S. government says it would punish China for that.
The Chinese government now has got the message that they will not have an easy path of asserting their authority.
The U.S. takes a stand on religious freedom for Buddhists on the world.
And join us for the broadcast of the world this afternoon at 3 p.m. here on Maine Public Radio. A reminder about the weekly Maine's Political Pulse podcast and the Maine Political Pulse newsletter. Both are available online at mainepublic.org, but you can also have Political Pulse newsletter delivered straight to your inbox on Friday mornings. You can subscribe to the Political Pulse newsletter right now at mainepublic.org/pulse or by clicking on the Maine Public Org News drop-down at the top of the page and then select Maine Political Pulse.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Governor Janet Mills. Tomorrow, she unveils her biennial budget. Share your comments or questions via email, a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Ross, who's calling from Lisbon. Hi, Ross. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Governor, I know that one of the topics for today's show is when you might be able to release some of the restrictions on travel and businesses. And I'm in the tourism promotion industry, and a lot of folks that I work with are struggling and investing in promotion because they don't know what the future holds. I guess my question to you, how soon can you get some answers so that people can identify whether or not they can put marketing budget into promotion so that they can get those people or get their products and their advertisements into long-term print products and things like that that need planning now?
Well, Ross, thanks for the question. You know, I'm not a prognosticator. I can't predict the future. But what I sensed from last summer, the upside of last summer, was that people came to Maine in part because it's beautiful and we have great things to do here, but people came to Maine as well because we did such a good job, compared to other states at least, in keeping a handle on this COVID virus. And I think people understand that Maine is one of the safest states in the country. That's the way I'd like to see us being marketed. I'm not sure which sector of the economy or the tourism economy you're representing, but I think that the restrictions right now are fairly low key. I mean, we've told restaurants and other eating establishments to close by 9 p.m. I don't know if that's terribly onerous. I think it makes sense from a public health perspective. We haven't closed those restaurants. We've simply told them stop serving and close at 9 p.m. And the other thing is on bars, the number of bars involved in that restriction, not very numerous, but I don't know that that's put a whole crimp in the economy or in the tourism economy. Other than that, I think you must be referring to the travel restrictions. And just about every state has, many states have those now. All of New England has them, certainly. And that depends whether we continue to impose or require either positive test or quarantine for somebody coming from most other states depends a great deal on the progress of the pandemic and the progress of the vaccination program. When we can be confident that people traveling from one state to another will not carry the virus with them is when that restriction in this state and in other states will be lifted.
All right, Ross, thank you for calling in, and thank you, Governor. I'm going to move on now to an email. This is from Peggy. In light of the attack on the Capitol last night and President Trump's incitement of insurrection, I would like to ask Governor Mills if she will organize with other governors today to request that the Vice President, Mike Pence, invoke the 25th Amendment.
Wow. Boy, I haven't been asked by other governors to do that. I'll keep my eyes open for any new emails and fresh communications from other governors. I haven't heard of such a campaign at this point. I know at least one member of the four-member congressional delegation has called for that. I don't have a sense of whether how the Congress would respond, or whether the cabinet will support that in force or not. It's entirely up to Vice President Pence and the members, current members of the cabinet right now, whether to do that. And I hope they have their eyes on the ball. I can't prejudge what they will do, or prejudge what the current president is intent on doing in the next 13 days. I would hope he stands down. Most transitions in government at the highest levels in this country have involved an outgoing president talking about their accomplishments, talking about their concerns, talking about how they wish they could have done better in some respect for the American people, talking about what they did do for the American people, and going out on a high note, whether win, lose, or draw. That's what I'd like to see happen. Let's do a comparison. Let's talk about the good things that have happened and talk about the good things that are to come. He can facilitate that, and he should.
Let's go to Rachel, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Rachel. Go ahead.
Hi. My dad is a long-term patient at a hospital, and he would otherwise be in a nursing home, but there have been placement difficulties regarding the level of care he requires. And so I'm wondering if he would be able to be included in the 1A because he would otherwise be at a nursing home, and if the CDC has included in its planning long-term residents of hospitals who would otherwise be placed in nursing homes.
Oh, that's a good question, Rachel. And I'm sorry I don't have an easy answer for you. And I'd be curious to find out, and I will ask, how many people might fall in that category and why your father is prevented from being transferred to an appropriate facility, whether it's a skilled nursing facility or some other kind of long-term care facility. And I'm very sorry this has happened to you, him, and your family. It's a terrible bind to be in. I'm happy to try to find out more, look into it. I can't tell you that he would automatically be in the next category or in 1A or in a higher level of 1B at this point. I don't know what his age is or other vulnerabilities, but we're looking at all those criteria as we go down the road and try to get as many people vaccinated in Maine as possible as quickly as possible.
Rachel, thank you for your call and good luck to your father. Robert on Facebook writes, the state's climate action plan was published on December 1st. How does the new budget implement the priorities in that plan?
Oh, thanks, Robert. The climate action plan does not necessarily depend on general funds or on state budget itself. Take into account, to a large extent, other funds that may be available. For instance, there is still money available through the Volkswagen settlement. You remember when I was Attorney General, I and other Attorneys General and then the Department of Justice on the federal level joined in a massive lawsuit against the VW, Volkswagen of America, and that resulted in millions of dollars to state governments for the purpose of reducing the effects of climate change. And in our state, as in other states, that money is being used to install electric vehicle charging stations, for instance. And there are other sources of funds for heat pumps and for electric vehicle and for weatherization. I'm very keen on weatherization programs, and there is money available. We've been talking to Maine Housing about how they might use the newly appropriated funds in the most recent congressional stimulus package, relief package, to weatherize homes and to install heat pumps and other more efficient heating mechanisms and get Maine people off of their dependency on fossil fuel. You know, we have one of the highest dependencies on fossil fuels for home heating resources of any state. And we send about $5 billion a year out of state to the fossil fuel companies to support our dependency on fossil fuels for home heat. And those are the kinds of things we want to change. But that doesn't require appropriations necessarily in the state budget. So I think that's the answer to your question. I hope it is.
Liz on Facebook asks, there is a planned anti-masker event planned for Saturday in Augusta. How concerned are you and law enforcement about this upcoming event that will undoubtedly be heavily attended by supporters if the president, egged on by the former governor?
I'm not sure that anybody's egging on any particular protests in Maine. I'm not tuned into that. There have been fairly regular protests at the State House on weekends, on Saturdays, I guess, and I'm not usually here. I'm not usually around to see them. But as far as I know, they've been peaceful, and I expect that that will continue. To the extent people are concerned about any results of the election, they're free to voice their concerns.
All right. We'll go to John calling from Farmingdale. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. Appreciate you taking the time. And thank you, Governor Mills, for all the work you've been doing under difficult circumstances. My question might be a little bit off topic. Asking about the CMP corridor, but it is timely because there's a citizen drive to get that onto the ballot in November. And it seems to me that, you know, the majority of the Maine public is against it, and seems like a false choice between, you know, having renewable energy and preventing a tremendous and permanent damage to the western wilderness of Maine. So I just want to take the opportunity and just ask you, you know, why would you want to throw your support behind what seems like a big money grab of iGrid and Quebec Hydro to the detriment of the Maine public who doesn't want it? Thank you.
Well, thanks, John. And no question is off topic, I don't think, frankly. And I welcome the I welcome your opinion on the matter. I welcome everybody's opinion on the matter. I want to make sure people are as informed as possible about any issue, including the issues regarding the CMP corridor. That corridor was first proposed almost 3 years ago, that transmission line. It has been vigorously opposed by, quite frankly, companies like Calpine and other fossil fuel-dependent companies, which concerns me greatly. I always ask the question, who stands to gain if it doesn't go through? Who stands to lose something financially if it does go through? And I think the answer probably is obvious, and that is that the fossil fuel companies will lose market share to hydropower, assuming this goes through. I want to just point out as well, from an environmental standpoint, this matter went through vigorous review by the Department of Environmental Protection for about at least a year, if I remember correctly. And it went through a review by the Army Corps of Engineers, and it went through a review as to public necessity and convenience by the Public Utilities Commission and by nonpartisan, non-involved, not stakeholder folks, experts at every level in all of those venues. And they all unanimously agreed without any political influence that the line was appropriate. You know, you're talking about Western Maine. I live in Western Maine. I'm about a mile from where the transmission line goes through now and where it will be expanded. Right now, there's one of the largest solar farms in New England, if not in the Northeast United States, going on, being built in Farmington, Maine, with a huge new transformer going right through town. The line is expanded already, going right through town. And that doesn't offend me because it's serving a good purpose. And if we can get better rates and better rates from renewable energy sources through this transmission line and a benefit package that will assist not only Western Maine and Franklin and Somerset counties in particular, but assist all ratepayers across the state and assist us in encouraging electrical vehicles and encouraging and funding broadband, expansion of broadband, not only in Western Maine but down to the coast. And help us expand heat pumps. There is the previous governor was negotiating with CMP, and I negotiated directly with Hydro-Québec for the use of power from that line for Maine consumers. So it's not all going to Massachusetts. I negotiated for enough power from that line in excess of what they need to supply Massachusetts to supply 70,000 homes in Maine. That's pretty significant, at a discounted rate. in addition to the money for electric vehicles, the money for heat pumps, the money for broadband, which, as we all know through this pandemic, is more, the need is more critical than ever before. I upped the ante, so to speak, to about $258 million in rate reductions and subsidies and scholarships and the like, plus the added benefit I negotiated this past year of power to Maine people. 70,000 homes, as many as 70,000 homes, can access power at a discounted rate. So I think those benefits, on balance, outweigh the line being driven through Western Maine with the enormous restrictions that the DEP put on, the physical restrictions and environmental restrictions they put on the construction of the line itself, meaning, I think the, what's the width, 50-something feet? Anyway, they reduced the footprint of the line substantially and imposed restrictions in terms of the cutting and the plants and the environmental aspects of the line. There's 300 pages of restrictions from an environmental standpoint alone on the construction of the line in that particular part of it.
John, thanks for your question. We are going to take another break. If you have a question for Governor Janet Mills, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you might be able to get a brief email in, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Rising Tide Brewing Company, committed to embracing winter with individual heated bubble tents on its outdoor patio. Reservations at risingtidebrewing.com.
As the news gets more complex and changes through the day, you need more than just a quick headline check. Here and Now keeps you connected to your world between Morning Edition and All Things Considered, as the news and the people shaping it are changing in real time. I'm Robin Young. Follow along on Here and Now, NPR News every weekday.
Here and Now, upcoming at the top of the hour at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. A thank you to Brian in Freeport for donating your 2013 VW Jetta to Maine Public. Do you have a zippy ride that you find yourself driving less and less? Well, please consider donating it to Maine Public. It's easy and there's no cost to you. Visit mainepublic.org for all the details. Donated cars make it possible for us to do more here at your public radio station.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, Governor Janet Mills is our guest. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'll go to Rich calling from Moosehead. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. In 2013, under Governor LePage and the legislature, the Tramway Safety Committee was dissolved that has oversight of our ski lifts in the state of Maine. And due to multiple accidents at Sugarloaf Spillway and Sunday River and one at Squaw Mountain and Moosehead Lake, we now have the worst record in the nation for accidents and injuries due to malfunctions. And I wonder if you would consider reforming the Tramway Safety Committee and putting a public advocate or member on that board, as Colorado does, to protect people that come in with complaints or whistleblowers that come forward. I'm just concerned that the oversight now is not there in place for our aging infrastructure. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you, Rich, and thanks for the information. I will follow up, look into the status of that safety committee. That concerns me greatly as well, although I think we have a fairly good track record overall. I remember the incident at Moose Mountain some years ago, and obviously we've been working with the Attorney General's office and other people in the Moosehead area and Greenville to bring back that mountain in particular. And I just want to applaud you for your interest in that and in the safety generally of skiers and ski operators. And I'm really hoping we can take back Moose Mountain, and because Greenville and the Moosehead area should be and can be and will be again a four-season resort area where people will come and use the top of the mountain, not just the base of the mountain, for recreational purposes. And very hopeful about that. But the safety concerns you bring to my attention, I thank you for that, and I will follow up.
We'll go to Carolyn calling from MDI. Hi, Carolyn. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am understanding this morning that there's a lot of concern in some of our immigrant communities, and especially the Somalian, because these are people who have seen this kind of violent attempts to interfere with government and the racism. And I just feel my heart goes out to this community today. They must be having a lot of deja vu, a lot of PTSD, a great deal of fear. They're in the whitest state in the union. And I'm just wondering if Janet Mills can say something specifically to our immigrant communities of color that might in any way offset the terror that they must be feeling today.
Oh, Carolyn, thank you for that concern. That's very thoughtful of you, and to remind me that we are diverse communities, even though we are, as you said, quote, the whitest state in the country. We are not diverse in our compassion, in our care about one another, including new Mainers from all parts of the globe. When you attend one of those swearing-in ceremonies, those naturalization ceremonies, you realize that people come from 50, 60 countries at a time, and they learn American history. Some of them know more about American history than many of our high school students, and it's amazing what they go through to become citizens of this country. And I have so much great respect for them for that effort. But in terms of today's impressions, you're right. It was ironic to me that last night on the news, the country of Turkey was commiserating and condoling us for the attempted coup in Washington of the state capital, of the United States Capitol. Turkey, of all people, of all countries. Our immigrant communities are sensitive to this, and I hope that they continue to feel welcome in this state and in this country, because they should be. They always have been. That's why the Statue of Liberty exists and is where it is, to welcome people from all countries across the globe and to offer them freedom and opportunity and respite from religious persecution and hate and violence. They are here. They're welcome here. And I hope that they know that in our hearts, they are part of our communities. They are part of our state. We need them. And we welcome them.
Carolyn, thanks for your call. We'll move up to Wyndham and John. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Governor Mills. And before I ask my question, I just want to say thank you for the incredible response that you've had during this pandemic. I just want to applaud you. And I think a lot of Mainers appreciate everything that you and Dr. Shaw have done to keep our state safe. You're welcome. You're welcome. The question I have is, with the recent stimulus package that was passed, the federal government did not re-up money for the Family Leaves Act, the Medical Leave Act. And I'm wondering if, as a state, if there's any money that the state can provide to working families like myself who, you know, were struggling to work and to provide a learning environment for children who, you know, are in hybrid models. I'm home a couple of days a week with my kids, and I've been able to do that because of the FLMA or FMLA money. And I'm wondering, you know, is our state going to be able to help working families so that I don't have to be furloughed or I don't have to take a furlough from work? And yeah.
Yeah, no, good question, John. We're talking about this every day. Is one of the many things we're talking about that we wish the Congress would have continued and did not continue. It would be pretty difficult for us to pick up on in the state budget, pick up revenues to appropriate funding to continue that program at the state level without federal help. That's the short answer. The second answer is a little more comprehensive, perhaps, a little more detailed, and that is we do want to support childcare facilities. We put people have asked me about the CRF funds and where they were spent, and I would just tell anybody who's interested to go online at maine.gov /COVID to find a whole complete listing of where those monies have gone. And one of the important places that they've gone is for child care, to stand up more child care slots and child care subsidies and facilities. Also, support for the schools. There is significant money coming from the federal government to support the schools, and we are doing our share in the state budget to support the schools. We hope that in the coming months, where more people are getting vaccinated, more people will become immune from the pandemic, and at the same time comport with and comply with the public health precautions to keep everybody safe. I just want to emphasize, vaccines are not a substitute for public health precautions. They go hand in hand with keeping distance and washing hands and avoiding gatherings. Those will continue to be in effect for quite a long time. With the additional funds for education, with additional precautions and vaccinations, we are hoping that more schools can get up and running for in-person education more than ever before during the pandemic, which will also relieve the burden on working families and working parents. I'm still hoping that community organizations will come forward and do more after-school child care in school settings. I think that's really important to have that continuity. To have a child, a third grade, fourth grade, second grade, finish their school day and go down the hall to the gym, to a facility nearby, and have appropriate after school care in a school type of setting with the help of the Boys and Girls Clubs, with the help of the YMCA, YWCAs, that kind of thing. And we hope that there'll be enough money in the budgets in the federal lines to continue those kinds of programs to help people like yourself with home care and child care.
John, thanks for your question. An email here from Barbara. With the rising number of COVID cases in our state and hospitals seeing rising numbers and vaccines not being as abundant as originally promised, do you plan on adding more restrictions like were implemented last spring? For example, limits on people in shopping centers, et cetera. And just to note, Barbara is not the only person concerned about shopping centers and big box stores.
Oh, wow. Shopping centers and big box stores. I've had numerous conversations with the proprietors of the Maine Mall and management folks at Target and Kohl's and Walmart and Hannaford, all the big stores, and Commissioner of DECD, Heather Johnson, has a lot of conversations with those folks frequently. And when we toughened up the mask mandate in December, I did so only after talking with them and saying, you know, here are the alternatives, folks. Here's what our concerns are, and the numbers are rising, and I've got to do something to put this genie back in the box if I can, back in the bottle. And they came forward and talked about messaging. They came forward and talked about interior capacity limits and those kinds of things. Those things are always on the table, but I think the numbers of people going to shopping centers and the like right now are down since the holiday season has passed. But it's something we're looking at, you know, regularly, every week, if not more frequently. A lot of people are, of course, shopping online as well. But I think I would only make effective additional restrictions after a full and robust conversation with the proprietors of those stores to see if they are, to make sure that they are now fully enforcing the distance and masking mandates to protect people with existing restrictions.
All right. We'll go to Kyle calling from Princeton. Hi, Kyle. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My mother just recently lost her husband to the coronavirus. And I was just calling to find out maybe something that we don't know, or if there is some sort of a financial support or like a financial relief for people who have, you know, lost a spouse to, you know, the effects of coronavirus, where they've, you know, gone from a two-income household and now they're down to a one-income household, and, you know, they're kind of stuck in limbo on what to do and maybe what the proper steps are to help them out in, you know, their time of need.
Well, I wish there were an easy answer. Thank you for the question, Kyle, and I'm so sorry about your mother's husband. And these tragedies are happening every day. It's frightful. In terms of, there's no easy answer to what your mother should do, but obviously checking into her Social Security benefits or any life insurance benefits that her husband left or had. Talking to a lawyer about probate and talk to a lawyer about any benefits to which she might be entitled would be the first step. In terms of any robust general support for folks who have lost others to COVID or to other diseases, there is no federal or state fund specifically for that. I'm not aware of anything in the massive bill that was just passed by the Congress a week and a half ago that would help your mother in those circumstances, I'm sorry to say.
Kyle, good luck to your family, and thank you for your call today. Let's see, I'm going to go to Carol in Cumberland. Carol, if you could be quick, we're coming toward the end of the program. Thank you.
I will. Thank you. First of all, thank you, Jennifer, and thank you to you, Governor Mills, and to Dr. Shaw, and the state and state folks in general being so accessible to us. You're welcome. But my question is, having this horror that just happened in Washington, which was shocking, my question is, that could happen here. I don't, you know, there's pieces that, of course, would not, because you're not who he is. But what could it happen here? Because in seeing that, it was, like, shocking. How, where were where was the preparation for that, and what were the steps that should have, as soon as it happened, should have been happening?
Well, Carol, thanks for the question. I can't say, you know, I don't want to comment on security in the state's capital because that wouldn't be appropriate. People like myself and others all have questions about security at the United States Capitol now, and I'm sure that'll be thoroughly investigated. I hope we don't end up living in sort of a police state or under military rule of sorts, or make it seem like military rule, but I hope for the best. I believe, as President-elect Biden believes, that that incident does not reflect the character and nature of American people, that we can and will do better, and that means Maine as well. We'll do better. Continue to debate and deliberate and protest peacefully and argue among one another, but do so disagreeing without being disagreeable, disagreeing but coming together in the end to forge a better future for our people.
Well, Governor Janet Mills, thank you so much for spending an hour with us on Maine Calling today. Janet Mills, serving her first term as governor of Maine. Today's sound engineer, George Thomas. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.